For a lot of people, I think the best part of a garden is its fragrance. We'll talk about that today on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, my guest Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Great place to visit. And we'll talk with him about the gardens and about how to successfully add fragrance to your landscape. And again, answer your gardening questions. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@ideas.wpr.org. Let me say that again. ideas@wpr.org. I've got to get used to this new email. And go to our Facebook page. Maybe you've got a great garden photo or a garden question. You can also post it on our Facebook page. Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry.
For those who aren't familiar, before we get started on the flowers and such, I want to talk about the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. It's a beautiful place to visit. Tell us about that.
You bet. Well, the gardens themselves are on our 28th year of history. We're a 20-acre botanic garden, a private nonprofit. Mm-hmm. We're on City of Janesville land. But the intent with the gardens is education. And along those lines, we have 26 distinct garden themes that encompass about 4,000 types of plants. Over the years, we've seen about 100,000 visitors a year coming for events and education, and certainly to enjoy the gardens. And we're positioned right off of I-90. So
yeah, it's great.
It's right there,
a couple of minutes off the I-90 interchange.
Yeah, right there. And you know, it's amazing to hear folks that have always wanted to go and haven't been. And you know, over the years, it's nice to see people finally come and see what we're doing. And again, our hope is to inspire and to educate. That's why we're there.
Yeah, and you've got a lot packed into that 20 acres. You do such a nice job, I think, of, you know, I think if it wasn't planned right, it could look kind of busy, or I don't know how to exactly put it, but you kind of flow from one theme to the next through the garden, and it's a wonderful place to visit.
Yeah, we get that comment a lot. It's very experiential in that with these different garden themes, you sort of flow through.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment is frequently that it seems a lot bigger than 20 acres. But, you know, the intent is displaying a wide range of plants and different themes. And again, hopefully people take some ideas home.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about fragrant. By the way, you're officially open. When do you officially open for the season, or are you open all the time?
We're open year round. Although you know we are starting to see some early blooms, and we start charging admission in April. But right now it's free for a nice winter walk. People can go today or tomorrow if they like.
Did you say you're getting some blooms?
We are. We have snowdrops, winter aconite, Danford iris, a little. All these minor bulbs that would normally bloom at the end of the month are early this year. So.
One of your themes this year is fragrance in the garden, is it not? What inspired you along those lines?
Well, when you think about the experience of the garden, a lot of us lean heavily on the visual experience, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think it's, you know, when you experience scent in the garden, engaging that sense, I think, adds more to the experience itself. And there's so many wonderfully fragrant plants. And years ago, we developed a smelly garden theme. It's what we called it. And it was in our children's garden. And for children of all ages to experience a wide range of fragrances, it was such a hit. We've done it two or three times. And we always include fragrant plants in the garden. But
sure,
this year, an additional focus on those specifically.
Well, it's fun. And you know, here on Garden Talk, there have been many, many times when people have said, oh, I've got this wonderful-looking rose or this wonderful-looking flower, and there's no smell, and they're not happy.
Right. Well, scent is usually overemphasized in plant catalogs, and the idea of scented, first of all, it's subjective. We all like different smells. But
sure,
I think it's exaggerated in many cases, so focusing on those things are really tried and true in terms of fragrance that you enjoy is achievable.
Yeah. Well, Mary in La Crosse has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
This fits right in with the question I wanted to ask. I have an apartment, but I usually have room for about 30 pots. And this year I wanted to plant all pollinators, but one plant that I do plant every year is heliotrope because it is fragrant. But this year I would like to plant in my containers, and I don't care if they're perennials or annuals, but I would like to plant all pollinating plants. so I can start it, making a nice little place for the bees.
Oh, it's a nice idea, Mary. And do we have some pollinators that are also smelly?
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting when you think of scent, and Mary mentions heliotrope, which is very sweetly scented.
Yes.
And, you know, scent in plants, emission, you know, scent can be provided from leaves by rubbing them, like our herbs, but the emission of scent by plants is typically to attract pollinators. So heliotrope, I'm sure Mary's observed lots of bees and other insects on that. But some other great plants might include some of the smaller fragrant flowering tobaccos. There's some great evening blooming annuals. There's a great one called Night Phlox that tends to open at night. And, you know, of course, you'd have to be out at dusk or in the evening to really enjoy that scent personally, but the reason it's emitting scent at night is to attract evening pollinators, typically moths and some of the other insects that are more active at night. So, you know, again, back to your question, there's a wide range, particularly of annuals, that'll provide scent through the entire summer. And when you think of duration of scent, there are fragrant perennials, but you know, that comes and goes with the period of bloom. So we lean very heavily on fragrant annuals. So again, back to flowering tobacco, you've mentioned heliotrope. There's fragrant stocks or Matthiola. Many of the dianthus, annual dianthus like Sweet William, extremely fragrant. So, you know, do a little exploration at the local garden centers and see what they're providing. But we lean on a combination of plants for scent really from April all the way through October.
I got to tell you, that flowering tobacco, I had some, I didn't have it last year, but I had the year before. And you're sitting, and we like to sit on the porch in the evening. And so it is absolutely perfect for that because that's when it's the most fragrant. And it really smells great.
It is. And keep in mind with flowering tobacco, and Mary mentioned heliotrope, there are some flowering tobaccos that have no scent, and there's some heliotropes that have no scent. And some of the modern breeding has eliminated scent in many of our plants. So when you select a variety, make sure it is advertised or promoted as having fragrance.
Yeah.
How about marigolds?
Marigolds have very little scent in terms of blooms, unless you're right up into them. So in terms of emission over like a certain radius, very minimal.
But they will attract.
Oh, for pollinators. Absolutely. But
yeah.
Fragrance very, very minimal.
Yeah.
Are there any other annuals that you can suggest that I could seed into containers? That's why
seed?
I was thinking about marigolds.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well,
and also, is flowering tobacco what we used to call Nicotiana?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Nicotiana. And for containers, there are some smaller forms. There's a perfume series that are only 24 inches tall because there are some gigantic ones that get huge. But in terms of sowing into your pot, aside from the dianthus I mentioned previously, look into old-fashioned petunias. Normally, petunias don't have scent, but in the smelly garden I mentioned earlier, we've obtained a lot of old-fashioned petunias that are extremely fragrant. And that's something to look into, and extremely colorful through a hot summer even. So again, there really are a wide range of things you can promote in terms of scent.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Mary. Appreciate your call very much. And you're going to have a fun outdoors there on your patio. Thank you. Taylor in Peterson, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Taylor. Thank you for calling.
Hi, great show. I was just telling your caller a few years back, 2010, I took a trip to see some relatives in Boca Raton, Florida, and just down the road in Delray Beach is a place called the Japanese Morikami Gardens. And I picked up a couple souvenirs before I left, and one of them is a calendar with pictures of the plants and the flowers and the bushes and whatnot from around the garden. And I told your screener that every time I take that calendar out and I look at it, I can remember that spot. And I can, it brings back the scent. It's like you can instantly remember the smell.
Oh.
And the place is just absolutely peaceful. And the fragrance is just, it radiates throughout the many acres of the gardens.
Oh, man, that sounds great, doesn't it? Oh.
Yeah, it's interesting with the idea of scent invoking memory. For those with memory loss issues or cognitive disabilities, what they're finding is the memory of scent is a lot more established.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Right. So someone who might be suffering some memory loss, the smell of lilacs might bring them back to an earlier period in their life, or they might smell lemon, and this aromatherapy approach using plants is found to be very effective. So I can see where scent would trigger memories and certainly garden memories, and that's one of the important aspects of it.
Well, I tell you, the Arboretum in Madison, I can't smell a lilac without thinking of the Arboretum in Madison in early May.
Yeah, Longnecker Gardens, it has one of the largest lilac collections in the country. And boy, when it's at peak, it's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Oh, you can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to Ray in Rhinelander. Ray, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. Nice to always talk with you, Larry, and the fantastic shows you have. Oh, listen, I have a question and an observation for your guest. I have quite the piece of property at the edge of Rhinelander. It's a half an acre, and I've got 72 variety of different things that come in every year. We had a lot of rain last summer, so about 20 other species came up that were dormant. It's just amazing how that happens. It has to do with butterflies. Now, there's so much research done. Is it scent also versus color? And what could somebody do with that? Also, I want to comment on what your host said about, how everybody basically, you said in the long run, how everybody loves scents and smells. Well, we used to do a lot of rehab. Well, I used to do a lot of rehab with people in a variety of different settings, drug and alcohol, mental health, you name it, in the correctional system. And a long time ago, a lot of these grounds had gardens that people would attend on them. And a lot of times if we had some people that were having a hard time with other symptoms in life, we'd take them into this garden and the scents would calm them down. And it was just amazing how when they were out in these gardens, how they just seemed to stabilize and come around, and we were able to work with them more in their rehab. So I just wanted to add that. Scents really do a lot for people in numerous ways.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, thanks so much, Ray. And you were wondering about scents to attract our plants that would attract butterflies as well, and... you got any ideas there?
Well, scent certainly plays a role in it. And, back to an earlier comment, the plants are not scented for human enjoyment. When you think of the fact that we enjoy the smell of lilacs, that emission is attracting pollinators. The scent that we have in herbs, for instance, basil, that's tactilely induced as we rub that and smell that and use it in a culinary fashion, that benefits us certainly, but the reason it has that scent are the essential oils, which are repelling insect damage on the plant. So a lot of the enjoyment of humans is secondary. But, back to butterflies, certainly color and flower architecture form plays a huge role. Many insects see in different spectrums. They might see an ultraviolet spectrum where flowers might have certain patterns or shapes that attract them for pollination. But scent is certainly important and is extremely important for evening pollinators because that helps guide them to the flowers where, again, with minimal light, that scent becomes even more important. And we did an evening garden years ago at Rotary Gardens, and it was just amazing at dusk how sweet it was. And we saw the moths come out, and really amazing. But pollinators, certainly there's a tie-in with scent.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about the flower gardens today with our guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for being with us here for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens. And we've callers online, still one line open for you at 800-642-1234. Let's turn, though, to Sarah in St. Mary's Point, Minnesota, who's up next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for your show. It's so inspiring before spring to be, you know, to have all these things to think about. A couple things. Wondering if you could put a list of different arboretums and garden centers to visit, just for inspiration, on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And then my question was, what kind of fragrant flowers can we put out for in the shade? I'm in a wooded area.
Yeah, so shade-loving, fragrant flowers. There's plenty, a lot to choose from, isn't there, Mark?
Well, there really is. You know, when you think about, obviously a lot of us will lean on plants like hostas when we get into the shade. And, of course, you know, deer like to nibble on those. That's a consideration. But there are many varieties of hostas that are promoted specifically for extremely fragrant blooms. So, you know, again, we tend to select hostas for their beautiful foliage, which makes sense. And many bloom with the lilac-type blooms, which to me aren't super interesting. But we have a couple excellent varieties at Rotary Gardens. I know there's one called Seventh Heaven. There's a good 20 to 30-plus varieties of very fragrant hostas that have nice dangling white bell-shaped blooms. Emission, you know, smells excellent. You know, something like Lily of the Valley is extremely fragrant. Now, the issue is knowing your plant, because Lily of the Valley can be a spreading thug, so to speak. But when it's at peak bloom in early spring, it's extremely fragrant, which is exciting. In wetter areas in the shade, things like snake root or simisifuga, now called Actaea, that blooms in late June, a very tall candelabra-like white blossoms, has a fragrance. But back to fragrance being subjective, half my staff thinks they smell horrible, like rotten soap. And
the other half loves them.
Yeah, and this, again, is that simisifuga, so it will take quite a bit of shade. But knowing your plant's important, because in shade there's issues of root competition, drier soils, wetter soils. Keeping the plant happy is obviously important, but you can accomplish fragrant plants in the shade, certainly.
And we'll see what we can do about putting a list of garden centers to visit. Jill, did you get that? We'll put that up on our Facebook page, a list of garden arboretums and such to visit here in Wisconsin. We can put that up. Thanks.
That would be wonderful, except I don't use Facebook, so could you put it somewhere else too?
I don't know. I tell you what, shoot me an email, and when we get that list together, I'll shoot it back to you.
Well, aren't you great? Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Sarah. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Kevin in Bellevue up next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Great to talk to you guys today. Say, I'm trying to grow more bluish and purple-type flowers, like a delphinium, in a perennial sense in our zone, obviously. Just wondered what you have recommendations for that. And the only other question I have is, if I plant something in a large, let's say, casket size planter, can perennials survive that if there's a certain amount of soil all the way around and below it? Or is that typically you can't survive a flower or a perennial in a large planter?
And your zone is, what's your zone?
Probably 3 to 7. I'm in Dubuque, Iowa, near Madison.
Oh, Dubuque. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Well, Kevin, you brought a lot of great points up. First of all, I think purple and blue are the most underrepresented color in all our gardens. You know, I've never gone into a garden and said, boy, that's too much blue. And I think we need more of it. When you talk about perennials that offer blue, delphinium, certainly, there's a great range of blues. They're a little touchy, and they're fairly short-lived. There's some shorter perennials that would be hardy for you, like perennial salvias. There's veronicas. Again, there's a wide range of blue-blooming perennials. The challenge is that blue is offered for 3 to 4 weeks, so you need to consider a segue of bloom if you want to carry blue through the garden. Don't ever hesitate to use blue foliage plants, too, though. You know, combine those. Now, the elevated planter, the real challenge is we get a horrible, horrible winter. That's going to freeze like an ice cube. And it's not fair of me to say that perennials won't survive in there, because there's years they will. There's perennials that are tougher than others. But I shy away from elevated planters simply because if we get a winter like we did in 2012, where it was just absolutely brutal, it's likely most of those would have perished. People are now working on insulated containers and some other ways of trying to perpetuate plants. But another thought is, if you're using perennials in this elevated planter, pot them up in October and sink them in the ground, because that insulation, ground level insulation, will carry them over, and then you can pop them back in spring.
Oh, another way to look at it. Yeah, I actually had some luck with with some straw bales, putting them putting the pots on a board, and then surrounding them with straw. And I did have some luck, but it's not perfect. That's for sure.
Yeah, one other question, if I could. The old type of purple and white lilac bushes that have the fragrance, and typically I remember them in the 50s and 60s when I grew up, can those be that are the, not the miniature ones or whatever, but the ones that just kind of get away on you if you're not careful, that could grow 20 feet tall, can those be controlled in height without harming them?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
They shouldn't get to be 20 feet high of many of those, because you ought to be taking a third out probably every year or so.
Yeah, the French lilacs, the rejuvenation, taking out older canes, it makes sense. And some will lean towards 15 to 20 feet in time. The issue is the pruning is right after they're done flowering, so yeah. It's a little challenging. But there are compact forms of French lilacs now. So just so you know, some of the larger blue ones get too big for us, so we're using a variety called Little Boy Blue, which is 8 to 10 feet. So there are more compact forms of the traditional French lilac you're describing. So look for those, and you won't have to worry about too much of that pruning.
Yeah, Little Boy Blue.
Yeah, thanks. I'm just trying to get a high screen, so I don't want to go too low. But thank you so much.
Yeah, well, 10 feet's pretty good for a screen. Most of your fences and that are probably 8 feet, mm-hmm. So there you go. Midge in Waukesha, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning. My absolute favorite fragrant flower is a sweet autumn clematis.
Oh, yeah.
I have a trellis, and I have a plant on either side of the trellis. They grow up on either side and meet in the middle and make this huge cluster of white, delicate flowers that you can smell for yards away. So that would be my favorite.
Oh, you know, take a picture this summer and post it up on our Facebook page, would you, Midge?
I will.
I can picture it, but I want to see it, too.
Okay, I'll do that. I already have pictures, so I can send them along. And I enjoy your show. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks so much for calling, Midge. Appreciate it. And she's right. I mean, those are beautiful.
It's a great vine. And, you know, in our formal gardens, on our pergola, we have this 12-foot-tall structure, and we have sweet autumn clematis on all the pillars. And to Midge's comment, the only drawback, and there's very few with this plant, is you're waiting till, for us, it's September before it starts blooming. But for late-season fragrance, it's unbelievable. Blooms well into October. You can cut it back. It blooms on new growth. So we have some monstrous ones that get quite large. And there's a new variety called Summer Love, which is more of a purplish variety of autumn clematis. So also fragrant, but I think the classic white is beautiful. And we certainly enjoy it, and it's a hit in our late-season weddings out in that garden. People are really enjoying that emission of sweet fragrance.
Oh, I bet. Is there a particular soil? I've always had trouble with clematis for some reason. I can't. It dies on me.
They don't like heavier soils, like wet clay, but they'll grow in a wide range. Yeah.
That's the problem.
That could be it.
All right. Thanks again, Midge. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye. And let's take a call from Denise. And open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Denise from Dover, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to share something with you. I plant zinnias around my vegetable garden. And they're really easy to grow. I just plant them from seed, and they bring butterflies and bumblebees to my garden, which is very nice. It's some flowers, but mostly vegetables.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to share that.
Oh, thank you for calling. Zinnias, and they're pretty.
Zinnias are amazing, and we've done a pollinator's paradise theme for many years. And if I were told you can only plant one annual for pollinators, it would be zinnias.
Is that right?
Exactly, for what Denise mentioned. And you know, tons of butterflies, lots of bees, lots of pollinators. Keep in mind, zinnias can run the range in heights from 12 inches tall up to 4 to 5 feet. The old-fashioned zinnias are beautiful. I will comment, though, the best types of zinnias for pollinators are single forms, a single layer of petals. A lot of the double forms aren't quite as interesting to pollinators. So keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And mine do get very tall. They get 3 to 4 feet tall. They're really beautiful.
Oh, sounds great. Denise, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call very much. you know, here I am making notes on all the reminder notes for what I need to buy and get out in the lawn and garden this spring. Tom in East Troy, we'll turn to you. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Love the show.
Thanks.
Enjoy this every Friday. We have about a 300-foot labyrinth, and we'd like to transplant or make a lavender field out of it. And I'm curious to see what type of varieties of lavender would be hardy for our zone.
Sure. Great question, Tom. You know, first of all, it's important to consider lavender is not a herbaceous perennial. If it's growing well, it's truly a subshrub, meaning it has woody growth that you hope will refoliate in spring. In our climate, and I'm speaking for southern Wisconsin in particular at this point, although I know there's excellent lavender growing up on Washington Island due to the climate
right there,
the two varieties we recommend are Hidcote, and that's Hidcote, Hidcote, and then Munstead. So both Hidcote and Munstead lavenders, most lavenders are listed as Zone 5. Now,
perfect.
Don't get into Spanish lavender and some of the other, you know, touchier ones, but drainage is absolutely vital for lavender. So in our herb garden, we've augmented the soil is almost 50% sand for us.
Oh, really? Well, that's perfect for us, actually. It's a farm field, which is very sandy right up in that patch where the labyrinth is. So that's just ideal. We're mm-hmm. so excited to do this.
Oh, it'll be beautiful. And you know, plan on some losses, but ultimately, lavender, once established and happy with good drainage, will last a long period of time and is unsurpassed, really, for fragrance and beauty. Absolutely.
That's perfect. We're so excited. We appreciate the show. It's a great, great topic.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. I was just thinking back to a Wisconsin Public Radio trip that I made with some wonderful people to Hawaii. And one of the places we visited was a lavender farm. Mm-hmm. And it was gorgeous.
Yeah.
Up on a hillside. It was really...
Mm-hmm.
And you can do a lot with lavender in terms of everything from, jams to cooking with it to all kinds of things. Creams. It's an amazing plant.
Super plant, yes.
Super plant. Tammy in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I'm wondering about weed control. I have kind of a sort of a plan where I'm going to use as much I have to use some Roundup because I've got Canadian thistle, and it's really bad and really obnoxious. But also just using some other techniques, normal techniques, but even spraying with the salt-vinegar combo. I think somebody earlier on a different show said you don't even have to combine the salt. But then also even cream kind of stuff to prevent the seeds from sprouting. And I just wonder how early I can start doing that, because I already see some of these little buggers coming up, and I'm just wondering if I can start. I really have a terrible weed problem in the front yard. It's a long story, but it's terrible.
So you've got a garden area in the front yard, and within the garden area you've got weeds.
Well, the whole front yard is a garden area. There's no grass up there. So
cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got weeds, and gonna go with this kind of three-pronged approach, plus regular digging stuff up and whatever. But I've got some things like Bishop's Head, and I just can never dig up every little crumb of root. So,
well, remember, and I think comment on this, Mark. Something like vinegar and salt—that's can be wicked too, can it not?
Yeah.
In terms of what it can do to the other plants that you want to have growing.
Right. The challenge is obviously targeting those plants. Well, the Canadian thistle can be a nightmare.
Canada thistle's awful.
And keep in mind with depending on how the weeds, if they're growing back from crown growth, meaning they've rooted and they're just coming back, sometimes herbicides are the way to go. And we use Roundup as needed. You mentioned preen and pre-emergence. Pre-emergence, the timing is certainly dependent on how the spring is warming up. And I'm short of giving a product endorsement, we use very few pre-emergence because sometimes the timing is just difficult. And we've seen mixed results, to be honest. They operate by essentially when those weed seeds germinate, they will burn off the root in essence. So a pre-emergent shouldn't harm existing plants. But again, the application of herbicide, you have to be very careful.
Yeah.
So, you know, good old-fashioned elbow grease sometimes goes a long way, but it's if you have a perpetual problem, maybe additional mulching, or again, if you're determined to use pre-emergence, and I wouldn't dissuade you from doing so, your timing, it's coming up very quickly, because some of the earliest weeds will be coming up very soon in late March and early April in the southern portion of the state, and you need to apply those well in advance of germination. So the timing is probably getting close.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
And then I also wanted to add to the person who said that not on Facebook, anybody can go to your Facebook page, Larry, because it's a business page, so you don't have to, you don't have to be a member of Facebook in order to see your Facebook page.
Now, I should have said that myself, Tammy.
Yeah, you've got a lot of things on your mind.
Oh, thank you so much. And I really appreciate the call, and she's right. I mean, anybody can go to our Facebook page and take a look, so, and not have to be a member of Facebook. And I've said it in the past, but sometimes I forget. You know how that goes. Lois and DeForest, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I rarely hear during garden shows, which I listen to often, Larry, about hyssop as a bee, a bumblebee, a pollinator plant or flower. It's a perennial. I have it, but I don't hear much recommendations, I guess, for it. Is there a reason?
Hyssop. What about hyssop? Mark?
Well, hyssop Lois is absolutely right. It's excellent for pollinators, particularly bees. And hyssop itself actually is considered a fragrant plant because of the leaves themselves are quite fragrant, have a light minty scent to them. There are some hyssops in our climate that are considered annuals. There are many that are also perennials. Absolutely beautiful tubular-shaped blooms, and it's kind of a spiky-type plant. And I think Lois is right in that it's probably under-promoted, and it's great for pollinator gardens. When I've given talks and shown images of hyssop, beautiful for a long period of bloom. I do warn people if they have bee allergies and they're worried about having a lot of bees in the vicinity, don't plant hyssop by the back door because they're absolutely covered with bees in midsummer. But it's... Oh, go ahead, Lois.
I guess that's why I wanted to bring it up because, it does. I just have bumblebees all over when it's a good year for bumblebees, and last year was really not. I'm very, very sad about that. But and it is a perennial, so you do have to kind of control it a little bit, I think, right? Is that right?
Right.
Or watch.
Absolutely. Some can reseed, and it's important to clarify that there's a hyssop that is more of a woody plant that's marginally hardy for us that's considered kind of a subshrub like lavender. But we're talking about the Latin is agastache or agastache, and the reseeding can be prolific in some years, so you know it's not hard to cull out the herd as they reseed. There's a great one called Golden Jubilee, which has golden foliage and blue blossoms. And a long period of bloom, and again, we see the babies every year, and it's easy to relocate them or cull them out. But again, I'm glad Lois brought this up, because hyssop is not only a great, again, pollinator plant, but the fragrance of the leaves is delightful.
It is.
Yes, and someone wanted to know, you know, about other bluish-type plants, and hyssop is a bluish-purplish kind of color. Is that
Yes, most fall in the blue range, although there are some hyssops now that are agastaches that are in yellows and oranges and near reds and whites. So people should look up this agastache, and you find them at local garden centers. You find them in seed catalogs, and a really hard winter will knock them back, and you may lose some, but they're certainly worth the space in any full-sun garden.
May I ask one more question?
Sure.
And I don't know if you brought this up and I didn't hear it. The Mexican sunflower is an annual. I just discovered that flower last year, and it's ever blooming. The blossoms just keep coming, and they're a late summer fall flower for late butterflies and bees.
Mexican sunflower.
Mexican sunflower. It grows 4 to 6 feet tall, so you kind of have to know where you want to put it in your yard or garden.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great plant, and its Latin name is Tithonia. And if you can find it at garden centers or in seed catalogs, what Lois is mentioning, it comes in really bright orange colors and also yellows. And last year, our Tithonia, there's a variety called Torch, which is a tall variety. We had it up 9 to 10 feet.
Wow.
And
oh,
if someone were to ask me what's the number one plant that we see monarchs on, for us it's Mexican sunflower, Tithonia. Easy to grow, but keep in mind, to Lois's point, you don't see it really start blooming till August, but then it goes the distance till frost. So it's an excellent annual plant for butterflies in particular.
Yeah,
especially when you're looking for something that is blooming in the latter part of the, you know, the season when you have the adult monarchs coming through, you know, later in the fall.
Yeah, very, very good points. Lois, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. You know, we're talking about, we were just talking about sort of the late season. One of the problem areas is in the early the very earliest time for pollinators. It's one of the good points about Creeping Charlie is that it's flowering pretty darn early, and actually it's something that pollinators use. If you want to say something good about Creeping Charlie, there it is.
Yeah, and it's a durable ground cover.
Very durable ground cover. What other really early season flowers would you suggest?
Well, and if we keep in line with the comment on scent, we're only a couple weeks away from down in the southern portion of the state, vernal witch hazels, which are native to the southern portions of the U.S., but in essence, they have a very spicy fragrance.
Yeah.
And we're heading into bulb season where hyacinths will be blooming. You know, there's a lot of early season fragrant bulbs, and we segue into the earliest perennials. Keep in mind, May, and again, in the southern portion of the state, we see our fragrant viburnums. We head into mock oranges. A lot of our woody plants will provide excellent fragrance out in the garden for, you know, the 3 week period of bloom.
Yeah.
But that progression of scent can be provided with perennials, woody plants, but carry over scent through the summer with annuals.
We had a comment and a nice photo from Elizabeth on Facebook. And you were talking about Little Boy Blue earlier. She said it's actually registered as Wonder Blue. The National Lilac Register would not accept Little Boy Blue as it was too close to another name already registered. So if you're looking for the dwarf blue, search for Wonder Blue. That's the lilac that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I was not aware of that. That's good to know, and Elizabeth knows her lilac. So that will certainly help your listeners locate that compact form. So Wonder Blue in lieu of Little Boy Blue is what you would want to do for your search.
And she posted a nice photo on our Facebook page. If you want to take a look at what Wonder Blue, or what we were referring to as Little Boy Blue, go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mehler Show, and you're going to see a very nice photo from Elizabeth with that particular plant. Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. I'm Larry Mehler for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at flowers and flower gardens here on the Ideas Network today, and zeroing in a little bit on fragrant flowers for you, for your garden. But we'll take other questions as well as we visit with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Always great to have Mark come by. And certainly, if you've been listening, you know he's has some great answers and great suggestions. Call in with yours at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mehler Show. And I mentioned that photo from Elizabeth earlier. If you have a photo and want a garden photo or flower photo and want to post it up on our Facebook page, we always love to see those photos to remind us that, hey, it's not going to be too long, and we're going to have some flowering going on in our own gardens, and you already have flowering going on at the Rotary Gardens.
We do. Our earliest bulbs are up, and it's not the earliest I've ever seen, but you get a little concerned sometimes with an early start to things. But many of these minor bulbs, as we call them, are adapted to some cold evenings. So they'll be okay, and we'll see a lot more happening over the coming month. Absolutely.
Are there any fragrant plants that you would avoid in the garden? Avoid planting?
Well, when you talk about, you know, again, fragrance being subjective, you know, you think about, we're not too far away in our climate having skunk cabbage blooming, and that tends to have a little bit of a smell to it. Early flowers to also attract pollinators, but I haven't met a scent that I've really despised, to be honest. You know, some commentary on scented gardens, they'll say don't combine scents, but I don't know that that's typically an issue. But keep in mind this radius of scent comment, it will vary. And, you know, mm-hmm. we in our scented garden, we've included plants that smell like chocolate. And specifically, there's a chocolate cosmos and a chocolate daisy. Both are annuals. That smell of intense chocolate is there, but only by getting right up to it. So, you know, again, know that distance, because that may affect its placement in a container or a window box or proximity to your deck. So know the plant.
And you also mentioned to me off air that you have one that smells like popcorn.
We do. Yes, it's a hit for everyone. We've grown it for many years. it's called Popcorn Cassia, and it's a tropical plant. But in essence, absolutely beautiful, bluish green foliage. In our hot summers, it'll grow from 1 foot tall. Being planted in early June, it'll be 6 to 7 foot tall by the end of the season. Long spires of yellow flowers, and when you rub the upper bud in particular on this plant, it smells like buttered popcorn. So we take everyone through every tour we give, all the kids' activities, we say, you know, we take them to this popcorn plant, and it's absolutely mesmerizing. And when you think about engaging kids in the garden and our next generation of gardeners and environmentalists, when they go home and tell their parents, I smelled a plant that smells like popcorn, I wouldn't mind gardening. You know, that's a kind of a gateway plant for getting some new gardeners.
And it's Popcorn Cassia?
Cassia, yeah. Cassia.
Yeah, well, that's another one Cassia. I've written down. I've got a whole list here already. Let's go to Sue in Stoughton next. Hi, Sue. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to know if there's anything you can do early to take care of the Japanese beetle that is all over the raspberries.
Mm. Yeah, Japanese beetles, you know, it's a challenge because the issue you're dealing with isn't just the beetles that are on your raspberries, because there's a whole lot of chemicals you could use, but, you know, you have an edible plant there, and many of the chemicals that would kill off Japanese beetles are non-selective. They would kill off a lot of beneficial insects. So the Japanese beetle population fluctuates, and I can speak for our garden. We've seen it kind of ebb and flow, and we've had very little beetle damage the last couple of years. But beyond the adult beetles, there's issues where the larvae are overwintering in area turf. So at Rotary Gardens, our little 20-acre garden, what we're seeing is no matter what we do to control beetles, and we try to do non-chemical controls, even hand-picking, which takes a lot of time, we can't take a dent out of the population around the periphery of the gardens that continues to fly in. So I'm rambling on, but I don't have a great answer for you on how to deal with that.
Instead, with raspberries, at least you could put some sort of row cover over the top if you really had a bad infestation.
Yeah,
well... Maybe they won't be so bad this year, Sue.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And, and especially on raspberries, those are row covers are a pain.
Yeah, yeah, they are.
We have, oh, my goodness, Elizabeth sent us a beautiful photo of a monarch butterfly on Tithonia.
Yeah, there's that Mexican sunflower.
Is that a beautiful plant?
Oh, it's awesome. When you think about the architecture of composite flowers like Tithonia, that flat platform is wonderful for butterflies. And my comment earlier, later in the season, the monarchs are literally all over this plant. The variety Torch can get 6 foot plus. There's a variety called Fiesta del Sol, which is a 3 to 4 foot variety of this orange bloomer. It also runs in yellow. It's in every seed catalog. It's very easy to grow, but I'm glad it was brought up earlier because it's absolutely excellent in the full sun garden. You have to wait a little later to enjoy the blooms.
But it is a beautiful flower. It's like a bright orange.
Extremely bright orange, yes.
And then with a kind of a golden center.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really pretty. I love that plant. Do you guys have some events coming up? I wanted to make sure I mention that before we get too far along here. At the Rotary Gardens, what's your schedule like?
Yeah, let me run through a couple quick things. March 18th, which is coming up quickly, we have an all-day symposium. It's all on edible landscaping. you know, check out our website. We're heading into the season where we'll start selling bag compost in April. And then Mother's Day weekend, we always have a massive plant sale, which focuses on heirloom vegetables, herbs, shrubs, and some other goodies. It's only a three-day sale. But the season itself is upon us, and we have a wide range of other educational opportunities. And I'll say that two places to look are website, which is www.rotarybotanicalgardens.org. Very current with everything that's going on at the gardens. There's also a link to my gardening blog on that same website, and it chats about what's happening outside, so you can kind of see what's going on. So, you know, see what's going on down in Janesville.
Yeah, from Madison, it's a quick...
Mm-hmm. Quick hop.
It's a quick hop, and right off the interstate, there you are. And so I certainly highly recommend that trip to you. You've been gardening for quite a while. What still gets you excited about gardening?
Well, you know, I don't want to wax poetic about it, but I'll tell you. I mean, I've been at Rotary Gardens for almost 19 years, and I started when I was 12, if you're doing the math on my age. You know what excites me is seeing the kids come through the gardens. And, you know, I think there's – I'll get off the soapbox in a second here, but there's a huge disconnect with our children, and that's – they're not outside as much as they used to be. The idea of more educational activities or immersion, but we talk about scented plants and this popcorn plant maybe engaging in the next generation of gardeners. I just love seeing our guests enjoy plants. 40% of Rotary Gardens is different every year, so what really gets me excited is changing the look of the gardens every year. And it'll be different this year as well.
That's the really cool thing. If you can't go down there just once and say, okay, well, now I've seen it all.
Right, right.
Even through the season.
Right.
I mean, there's not only once a year is not enough, but certainly several times during the course of the year, you're going to see something different every single time.
Well, we head through a progression of about 400,000 spring blooming bulbs into our a lot of perennials, but our annual displays, it's about 150,000 annuals throughout the gardens. And then fall is nice, and we have a big light show. There's something going on throughout the year, and our hope is people will just come check it out and spread the word and repeat their visits.
We have Tim on Facebook says he's managed to overwinter a number of annuals, and he wonders if they have a lifespan. And he's thinking in terms of geraniums, sweet potato vine, coleus. Do they have a? Is there an end stage for them?
There is not. And when we think about the term, all three of those could be perpetuated indefinitely. And I use an example. My mom perpetuated geraniums by storing them in the basement for 30 years. So many of the plants we say annual are annuals. Botanically speaking, an annual is a plant that goes from seed to seed in one season. It finishes its life cycle. But the broader definition of a seasonal plant or an annual is a plant that may be a perennial or a hardy plant elsewhere, so it never truly sees an end of a life cycle. So perpetuating the tubers, the sweet potato vine, the pelargoniums, the geraniums, and so forth, coleus, you can continue to pinch the same coleus year after year, bring it in. People have perpetuated the same coleus for 100 years. So, you know, you can keep those three going. But, you know, again, know your plant and how to do that.
Elena in Marshall up next. Hi, Elena. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I had a question and I had a comment.
Okay.
So my comment was for the woman that called in about the beetle problem with her raspberries.
Yeah.
I don't know what experience you guys had with those scent traps, but we've had a lot of success with those, with pulling them off our garden, because we get Japanese beetles really bad in the squash plants and flowers. So we started using just a little bag, and you can get it at various stores, but you want to put it in a different corner of the yard, and it will pull them that way.
Yeah, you want...
It worked for us.
Yeah, you want either to talk your neighbor into doing it, or to get it as far away from your plants as possible, because it will draw in more than were originally there, if I'm not mistaken, Mark.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like Elena has the right of it, and that's, you know, again, it's the joke is you put them in your neighbor's yard again, because you need to make sure you clean them out. That's important, because scientific studies have shown that the populations they bring in, the traps can't keep up. And so once the traps are filled, Or, you know, again, that population will then start sniffing around the area to see if there's something to nibble on. So they're successful, but don't, again, always judge success based on them getting filled up, because if you're still seeing damage on your plants, then you need either more traps or to get them further away. So, yeah.
You've got a big yard, Elena. You can get it far enough away. What other question did you have?
So my question was, speaking of neighbors, what do you know about recommended plants that are hardy and fast growing that create kind of a natural hedge or a fence of a decent size?
Right. Well, you know, when you consider now, I have some neighbors that I've excluded with a living fence, a hedge, and because they're maybe not the best neighbors, and they're not listening, so I think I'm okay saying that. But we did an evergreen hedge. We did arborvitae, which is a common plant, because we wanted 12 months of screening and privacy. Mm-hmm. The issue out in the country or areas with deer is I would never plant that simply because of deer nibbling. But fast-growing, you know, deciduous-type plants like privet or some of the viburnums, there's some deciduous material that'll grow quickly into a living fence. The issue there, though, is you can see through it in winter, so you'd have to decide if you need a permanent screen.
Yeah,
I would kind of like more of a year-round plant, if possible, so that I'm not dealing with that die down, and there everyone is.
Yeah, and right. There everybody is. Well, your first suggestion then is probably a good one, Mark.
Arborvitae are good. You know, there's a lot of nibbling, but consider other upright conifers and plant them close enough that they'll fill in quickly, and
there you go.
You'll have a long-lived screen.
Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens, for Garden Talk. Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Degrees in landscape architecture, urban forestry, and certainly knows a whole lot about the garden. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments as we move along today. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Or if you've got a question to post and a photo, a garden photo to post on our Facebook page, go to The Larry Mealer Show. That's the title of our page. And we'd certainly love to see some more photos, so please do that. Let's turn to Nick in Green Bay next. Nick, hi. Thank you for calling.
How you doing, Larry? It's been a while. But I was just driving, and it just kicked me in the butt to call you guys. I just moved, and we used to have a raised garden. And now we've got a nice big fenced-in yard, and I'd like to put in a real garden in there, and I don't even know where to start, but I think the whole thing for me is even starting this garden, it's just as nice to have the kids to get together, and we just all kind of basically play in the dirt and, you know, good quality time, but I don't know where to even start. Like I said, I would like to get some corn and some tomatoes, and that's about as far as my knowledge goes. So hopefully you can suggest some light reading or, you know.
Okay. So there are some options. One option is to go to for some quick information and pretty good information, go to the UW Extension Learning Store. So if you go to learningstore.uwex.edu and type in, well, you'll find a whole host of bulletins and publications for free on gardens and starting a garden, starting a vegetable garden, starting flower gardens. Lots of great advice at that particular site, and I highly recommend it. Mark, you have any, I'm sure you have some things to add.
Well, I think it sounds like a great plan, Nick, and it's something I would do is I'll play devil's advocate. Make sure you temper your enthusiasm initially, simply because there's a couple things to consider. You need to know your soils, and, you know, as you're seeing seeds and going through catalogs, everyone gets excited about the upcoming season.
Yeah.
But there tends to be a tendency with a new garden to go too big. Yeah. I would encourage you to start small and expand as you go. Consider soil testing to know what you're up against. And if you're removing sod and creating an area of soil, don't ever underestimate the weed crop that's going to come up over the seasons. If you have the ability to do it, start small or even consider amending the soils after a soil test. Get it really prepped and consider a year of weed control before you even get at it.
Yeah, another way, and you can also, there are certain types of gardening. You can go online and look for lasagna gardening. Lasagna gardening as an example, because lasagna gardening, you're sort of layering different types of mulches and so forth.
Oh, okay.
And with that, you could get some weed control away with that.
Right. And I think it's important with plant selection. Obviously, you'll grow the things you like. You mentioned corn and tomatoes. Keep in mind with a limited space, also consider cost savings. Grow the plants, and I'll use myself as an example, at home in containers. My wife and I grow all of our hot peppers, bell peppers, tomatoes, because they're taking up a minimal amount of space, and they tend to be a little more costlier in the grocery store. If you were to clear a 1,000 square foot of garden, you know, two pumpkin plants would fill that. So know what you're getting into in space allocation for your vegetables, and again, consider the cost savings and the convenience factor in fresh produce is there. And I think you're on the right track. Just get your ducks in a row and have fun with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, there was a time I would make. I had a recipe for V8. A kind of a V8 tomato juice, and I'd make 50 quarts of it a year, so I'd have a quarter week for the year, and I'm gone for a couple of weeks of vacation. So, and I would raise all the tomatoes for that. Mm-hmm. I had a big garden, and you know what? They didn't ripen all at the same time, and so you were constantly going through that process. And at one point, I just decided, you know what? The farmer's market... I can go and buy a whole lot of tomatoes in one fell swoop. Certainly, I had my own tomato plants for eating, fresh eating and so forth. But then I could go and then I could can and get it all done in a very short period of time instead of having to do it over the course of several weeks.
Yeah, the convenience factor is there. And, you know, for us, we grow fresh herbs at home, too. And if you're running out to the grocery store to buy some of that shriveled up basil, you should be walking out the back door and snipping it fresh. I mean, the ability is there, and it's that falls into our scented theme. You know, there's so many of these fragrant culinary herbs that we can grow at home.
Yeah, absolutely. John in Elgin, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I was calling about Japanese beetles.
Yeah.
I tried a combination of the traps that the earlier caller said and milky spore. Have you ever heard of milky spore?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, it works tremendously, and it's not toxic. It produces natural bacteria. After 2 years, I can't say I eradicated them, but between the two, the combination, I also did some reading about those bags. They use a little pheromone disc that attracts the beetles. It says that doesn't travel more than 30 feet unless it's carried downwind, so you put it upwind, and it's supposed to be a myth that it attracts Japanese beetles from other yards. So what I did was put one set of traps by the worst tree that I had, and then I put the milky spore down. You put it down twice a year for 2 years, and then it's supposed to regenerate this natural bacteria that kills the grubs, which are the larvae of the Japanese beetles, and then it's supposed to keep producing this bacteria for up to 10 years. And I've practically eradicated Japanese beetles in my yard. And the other thing that's really nice about milky spore, it's non-toxic to pets or children or anything like that. You put it down, you might have to water it if it's a dry day. And after, I think it's like 48 hours, it's supposed to be okay. And it keeps regenerating itself after putting it down twice a year for 2 years.
Oh. Well, thanks, John, for calling. Mark, a comment from you?
Yeah, I think John's advice should be heeded by everyone who has Japanese beetle problems, because the milky spore, the research is showing it to be very, very effective. The non-toxicity is important. You know, again, with these sort of secular populations, we're seeing, you know, there's years where it's been horrendous in Janesville and other years where it's not so bad.
Yeah.
Treating the lawns for the larval stage is vital. And what we see before we were doing this, and we've used some synthetic products, which we're not real proud of doing, to get rid of the grub stage. But in essence, we're seeing, if you see late season turf damage, it's typically skunks or other mammals tearing up your turf to get at those grubs. And that's usually an indicator of having that issue. For our rotary gardens, we have an adjacent golf course that doesn't do anything for Japanese beetles, so we're still dealing with adjacent populations. But on the homeowner or landscape scale, I think John's advice is excellent.
Yeah, they blow in. Yeah, that's a nice golf course, by the way.
Yes.
it's a great golf course, but I'm sure it's a breeding ground for Japanese beetles.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, John. Appreciate that call very much. And it was good to bring that milky spore back up for discussion. Terry in Franksville, let's go to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, guys. Happy Friday.
To you as well.
I have more of a question about pine trees.
Okay.
I have four very old pine trees that are dying off at the front of my property, so I'm having them removed and the stumps ground. I want to replace them with new trees, and I'm not sure how I should treat the soil. Do I need to amend the soil? Do I need to add any nutrients before I plant these new trees?
This may be a soil test, may be in order for Terry here, Mark.
Right. Well, with the years and years of pines there, there's certainly, you know, the issue of the soil itself. The nice thing about the soil is it's probably slightly, the pH has probably been lowered. Pine needles tend to be slightly acidic, which actually isn't a bad thing at all. Keep in mind with your future trees, the rooting systems are going to be vast, well beyond the area that you've had the stumps ground out. And our feeling on tree planting is ultimately the trees are going to have to adapt to your existing soils. To Larry's point, I think a soil test would be important to see what you're up against. But,
okay.
But if that were my situation at Rotary Gardens and we removed pines and had it ground out, I might add some topsoil or some compost, but I would be comfortable putting trees in relatively quickly, a wide spectrum of different trees.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll need to do much, but know what you're up against with that soil.
And when you do the soil test, you can tell them what you're planning, what you're interested in planting, and they will.
Okay.
You'll get some advice from them. Typically, you'll get advice on perhaps trees that would work best for you.
Oh, excellent. I would like to do something that's more local to our area so they can withstand the winters and the road salt.
Yeah, well, mention that when you do the soil test as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Terry. And you can do that soil test anytime.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the soil.
Yes.
So I do it earlier than later just to get it kind of ahead of the rush.
Right. Take a couple different samples and talk to your extension agent. That's a great way to start.
Yeah, the Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory will help you out there. Lloyd and Hubertus, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How are you? I rarely miss your show.
Thank you.
I have a situation with mature spruce trees. They're like 30, 40, 50 feet high. There's six in a grove. And what's going on is I'm getting tip drop, thousands of them. And some of my neighbors are getting the same thing on their spruce trees. And I have researched it as much as I possibly can. Everything from people telling me it's red squirrels, which it's not, to something called spruce bud rot. But it's just the candle end. And there are literally thousands of them piled up. Just want to know about that. Am I going to lose my spruce trees? Is there anything I can do about it that's reasonable? And what are some of the causes?
How long has this been going on?
Oh, I had some drop last year, and this is the second year, probably
okay.
About 2-3 years.
2-3 years. Sometimes moisture, weather conditions can play a role, can't it, Mark?
That could be part of it. You know, I would encourage our weather patterns have been really crazy, but as those pieces are dropping, have you taken any samples to an extension agent or had any kind of prognosis on what's going on?
No, I called an extension agent, and by and large, I couldn't get them off of the red squirrel scene. Even when I explained that if there are red squirrels, I would see tracks. You know, you'd see some once in a while, and there's no red squirrels. That's about all I could get.
Right.
You know, and he asked me if the ends were chewed. And it's just the candle end, and
mm-hmm.
the ends aren't chewed at all. And it's my neighbors also. I'm seeing a lot of it around.
What do they look like? Do they look altered in any way? I mean, in terms of, you know, potential disease or something like that?
No, not at all. They are in an area where they will collect moisture sometimes after a big rainstorm, so they get a lot of moisture.
But, and the trees are all the same size. They're all around 40 feet high, about 40 years old. But the spruce tips are all exactly the same size,
mm-hmm.
about yeah. an inch and a half. And they're totally green. They're not browned out. And there's no browning on the tree.
And
yeah.
if you go on the Internet, I can find, 15 different opinions, but no one has any kind of definitive diagnosis.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's a difficult thing, and the fact that it's the way it's happening sounds to me more like it could be an environmental thing.
I think a sample, couple samples would really help, because there are some insects that will lay eggs and do things in the candle stage of evergreens, which will shed new growth. So my thought is, I know you, climbing up 40 foot's not something you want to do, but if you can collect some of these samples and really have someone take a look at them, I think that's your best approach. Because there may be an insect involved here, is kind of my gut feeling, but tough to do it over the radio without seeing it.
Yeah, you might, if you've got any photos, here's one thing you could do. You could send it, sort of going along with what Mark said, to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you can find the lab online, and there's a place for you to write your comments or whatever and questions. And if you send that in to PJ Leash, who is director of the Insect Diagnostic Lab, he may have some thoughts going along the lines that Mark was raising, and I think it'd be worth an email to PJ Leash at the Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Is that L-E-A-C-H, Larry?
L-I-E-S-C-H.
Yeah.
L-I-E-S-C-H. Okay.
But look at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you put that in your search engine, you're going to find it right away.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful, and I appreciate hearing.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And Kyle in Wausau. It's your turn. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
I have a question about a previous. I have had a sandbox in the corner of my yard for about 15 years now, and I want to turn it into a garden, but there is a lot of sand still in it. Is there any way I can add, like, compost or anything to it to achieve soil that I can use for gardening?
What kind of gardening? Vegetable gardening? Flower?
Yeah, just really anything. I mean, mainly vegetables.
Okay.
Well, the sand itself, obviously, it is not necessarily a bad thing, but the trick, I think, would be with augmenting that soil would be the challenge of creating enough tilth, a soil that would be adaptable for a wide range of plants. So, short of excavating it out, you can certainly maintain a certain percentage of sand in your mix, but it's likely you're going to have to discard or redistribute or relocate some of that sand to start with. I don't know the depth of the sandbox itself, but I'd be wary about trying to incorporate the full volume of sand. I think I'd get some of that out of there and really get some good organic matter mixed in.
Yeah, and it's only about 4 inches of sand, so not a lot.
Right.
Not a lot, so you can get rid of 3 inches of it, hopefully, and mix in some really good
compost.
And,
yeah. You
could get a good start pretty quickly in your garden centers. You're going to be able to, if you don't have your own materials, you can always get it at the garden center. Yeah.
Okay.
Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Just work that in and keep doing it every year. Pretty soon you're going to have pretty good garden soil.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty darn soon. Andy on Facebook wants us to know that we should avoid planting invasive honeysuckle and Dame's Rocket in our gardens. These are beautiful and fragrant plants that escape gardens, for sure, and destroy native habitat. Use native alternatives like viburnums, ninebark, or elderberry for shrubs, and then phlox and violets and toothwort are good for shaded areas. You're not going to disagree with that at all, are you, Mark?
No, Andy's right on. Unfortunately, various honeysuckles and even Dame's Rocket are still sold, which is kind of scary. And when people, a lot of Janesville has Dame's Rocket around it, and folks, when they see it in bloom, and think it's a wildflower, and it is not, and it's not native at all, and it spreads like crazy. So great advice from Andy. Lean on our natives, which are adapted to our soils, appropriate for our wildlife, and certainly beautiful in their own right.
Smita in Brookfield emailed to ask where she would plant, where she should plant night phlox, and where can she get these plants?
Ah, well, night phlox, I should mention, the Latin is a mouthful. It's in every seed catalog right before zinnias. It's called Zalusianskaya, and I think, Larry, I'll share that with you so you can get it on Facebook. But the Zalusianskaya capensis, this night phlox, very small little white flowers that open at night. And my wife and I, we incorporate it into our window boxes and our containers on the back deck. The emission is unbelievable. So when you go out at dusk in the evening, these little flowers open up, and it's unbelievable. You will not find it as a plant. Typically, you'll have to grow it from seed, which is not difficult. But again, check out your seed catalogs and try to start it yourself if you're comfortable with that.
Lynn emailed to ask for suggestions for a shrub to plant along the north side of her house, something that'll go 2 to 4 feet high.
Well, the challenge there is when I hear north side of the house, a lot of us assume shade. I don't know if there's a deciduous canopy or the north side of the house still receives morning and afternoon light for the most part. So in the past, a lot of folks have leaned on the standard things like yews and arborvitae, but they tend to be overplanted in our Midwest landscape. So the real challenge is finding something that'll that can be maintained at that height. So you could lean on I'm wary of recommending something because I don't know the soils.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an overhang, an eave, which would affect watering. So I don't know if it's dry or wet shade. So it's a challenging location. I would encourage, Lynn can certainly email me beyond today with more information on the site itself, and I could give a better recommendation.
And I think we have your email. We certainly have your contact on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show for the Rotary Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So just go there and...
Yes. I'd be glad to help, but more info, because I'd hate to recommend something that's just not going to thrive.
Patricia emailed to ask if you to talk about prairie drop seed as a late-season plant with a wonderful scent.
Prairie drop seed is a native grass, absolutely excellent in the full sun garden. And to Patricia's comment, its fragrance, when it forms its inflorescences, which are it's a combination of the seed and flower head, it starts blooming in midsummer. And once it really fills out, the smell is also, fragrance is reminiscent of buttered popcorn. Some people will call it drier, you know, like a dryer sheet. So, again, scent being subjective, it's a nice, clean, fresh smell. Olbrich Botanical Gardens here in Madison, Wisconsin, uses prairie drop seed to great effect. Keep in mind when it blooms, it's 3 to 4 feet, but there's a compact form called Tara, which is only 18 to 24 inches. But for a great native full sun grass with late season fragrance, she hit the nail on the head with prairie drop seed.
Well, here we are with about 45 seconds left. Any final words of wisdom for our folks when it comes to fragrant garden plants?
Well, again, my comments earlier about engaging the kids and fragrance can typically, we all enjoy fragrance for the most part, and plants can provide that. So get the kids involved. Patronize your local garden centers first and foremost. That's valuable. Ask them what they are carrying in terms of scented plants. But first, continuous scent in our Midwest gardens from April all the way till early October can be provided with a combination of our woody plants, particularly early blooming shrubs, carrying over with our segue of perennials, fragrant perennials from May through October, and also annuals cover the distance in our containers, etc.
Always a pleasure, Mark. You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
Absolutely.
Oh, Mark Dwyer, Director of Horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Go to their site and take a look. The directions are really straightforward, right off the interstate, a minute or two off the interstate, and you're right there. And you are going to be in for a real treat, no matter what season of the year you visit. And I would recommend visiting more than once, for sure. So Mark Dwyer will be back with us again. Well, we'll be talking about security software for personal computers coming up on Monday. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.